Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. India's former Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee once said that you can change your friends but not your neighbors. This credo would seem self-evident if there weren't so many countries still preferring to hold on to old grievances rather than pursuing the synergies of mutual development. What will it take to change this win-lose mentality? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Sudhindra Kulkarni, Indian political analyst and former aide to Prime Minister Vajpayee. Mr. Kulkarni, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Let me start with your early years when you were first infected with politics, not as a means of self-aggrandizing, but actually as a way of facilitating social development. I know that you started off as a Marxist, but then got disillusioned. Where do you find yourself in ideological terms right now?
Yes, I was once a Marxist, and I have not completely abandoned my Marxist roots, even though I got disillusioned and deviated from Marxism. There was a time when I was young, and as so many young people in the world in the 70s and the 80s, it was very natural to be attracted by Marxism, by socialism, because we all dreamt of a society free of exploitation and a society full of equality and equal opportunities. But as time went by, I saw Marxism in action, which is very different from Marxism in theory. And we all know how the world has changed in the 80s and onwards. Now I feel that there is a need to synthesize all the humanistic and positive ideologies and ideas from around the world, including Marxism, and create something new that can change the world. And in this, I find that the ideas and the ideals of Mahatma Gandhi are and can be a great contributor, because Mahatma Gandhi propounded ideals that are eternal and universal. Peace, brotherhood, nonviolence, love.
It's interesting you say that, especially in reference to Mahatma Gandhi, because myself being a child of the late Soviet Union and a student of political and religious ideas, I find a lot of overlapping between Marxist, communist, socialist ideologies and the major religions of the world, because they are all centered around the ideas of fairness, equality, freedom of choice, freedom to pursue your individual or national destiny, dignity, the idea of treating the other as you yourself want to be treated. And Mahatma Gandhi is one example of actually putting those ideas into practice, you know, marrying spirituality and politics. Do you think it's possible today? Because if we look around the world, whenever people bring some sort of religious ideas into the political realm, it seems to be, more divergent than diverging than unifying.
You know, whether it is possible, I would like to answer it by asking whether it is necessary. And I think that the ideas and ideals of Mahatma Gandhi and other similar philosophers are necessary for the present and the future of humankind. First of all, Gandhi was a person who deeply respected every religion in the country. He was, of course, a devout Hindu, but his respect for Christianity, for Islam, for Buddhism, for every other religion was equally deep. And today, in our globalized world, when people are interconnected and interrelated in an unprecedented manner, we have to know each other. We have to respect each other. And we have to learn from each other. And this diversity of the world is not a source of weakness. It's a source of strength, because it shows that humanity is so rich in experience, so rich in exploration, so rich in ideas, so rich in cultural patterns, and of course, artistic creations.
Now, I want to quote you specifically because you have written that history's dominant trend in the 21st century is toward equitable global development, assured global security, and democratic global governance. And despite the fact that you got disillusioned with Marxism, isn't this actually so much different from what Karl Marx was thinking about back in the 19th century? Surely the ways of bringing that about must have changed. But isn't it pretty much the same ideal that humanity has always aspired to?
You know, you're right. Marx also visualized a world that is one, that is united, and that lives with, in peace with itself. So therefore, I said that we need the basic ideas of Marx even now. Marx has not become outdated. What I am saying is that there were also other philosophers, other social reformers, and political leaders who dreamt of the same. For example, in India, the India's freedom movement against British colonialism was a source of immense inspiration, not only for the people of India, but for people all over the world. Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, Rabindranath Tagore, all of them were universal people. They fought for India's independence, but they also inspired people around the world.
Absolutely. And by the way, let me just tell you, because I live here on the in the northern part of Moscow, and right in my neighborhood park, there is a monument to Rabindranath Tagore. So, you know, like, you are true in saying that there were people thinking on the global scale. Now, you mentioned the word unity, and I think this is a very interesting and also very dangerous concept, because the United States and the West collectively are using unity as a sort of political tactic of pushing everybody under the same opinion, under the same paradigm. You know, essentially, what I think they are doing is, under the slogan of unity, they are enforcing their own views and doing that quite in quite authoritarian ways. How do you distinguish between authentic unity and, let's say, geopolitical unity that is used as a tactic of enforcing the privileged position?
The true authentic meaning of unity means that it respects diversity. Unity cannot be equated with uniformity. What the United States is doing is imposing its own hegemony or continuing its hegemony in the name of a false idea of unity, which is as per its own hegemony. Now, that must be rejected, and that is indeed being rejected. True unity of mankind means that we must accept and respect and celebrate the immense diversity of human civilizations in terms of arts, culture, spiritual traditions, philosophies, intellectual, scientific, technological pursuits. All this is a common heritage of humanity. And that is, out of this diversity, we should create new bonds of unity, solidarity, while respecting, and this must be underlined, while respecting national identities, national aspirations to follow their own path. There is not one single path that is applicable for all religions or all nations.
Now, I think it's not only a question for political scientists, but also for economists and perhaps even sociologists, whether the West can stand on its own feet. Because as much as Western leaders like to talk about diversity and, you know, like them serving the interests of humanity, it's pretty clear if you look at the data that the United States and the West are sucking up the resources from the rest of the world, and not only material resources, but also human resources. I mean, they're accustomed to getting the best talent from the rest of the world to the point that their own educational systems are now in many ways hijacked by ideologies. Do you think the West can actually stand on its own feet and be self-sufficient without putting this burden of supplying for itself onto the other countries in, again, under these slogans of, humanity and serving it.
Not at all. It's simply impossible for the West to stand on its own feet and especially stand on the heads of the rest of humanity by trying to perpetuate its hegemony. In the process, what is actually happening is that there is a progressive impoverishment of America in terms of its society, even its economy. Its economy, there is a lot of hollowness within its economy. It is propped up by the continued dominance of the dollar. But all this is changing. The world is moving towards de-dollarization. Similarly, as you very correctly pointed out, the talent pool, the native talent pool of the United States is shrinking. Let me give just one example. Very recently, TSMC, the famous semiconductor manufacturer from Taiwan, was forced to establish a chip factory in Arizona in the United States, for which TSMC decided to make a huge investment. And it gave a timeline of completing that project by 2025. But now they find that the work culture and the talent is simply not available. So they have said that, you know, we cannot do it in the next 2 years. So have advanced this is just one example. There are so many ways in which the West is actually declining and the rest of the world is rising.
But Mr. Kulkarni, even if I think objectively history is moving towards not only multipolarity, but also, you know, authentic balance of give and take, you know, each nation taking their own fair share of resources and, standards of living, the comforts of life. Do you think the West will actually let its monopoly sleep without a fight? Because we have a proxy war in Ukraine. At least we in Russia see it as a proxy war between Russia and the West in Ukraine. There are mounting tensions, and I think methodically stoked up tensions around Taiwan and China. I think there are also clear efforts by the West to recruit key regional players as a means of ensuring Western control over various parts of the region. What do you think the end of Western hegemony will look like, and will the planet survive it, actually?
The West will certainly not give up its dominance, its hegemony without a fight. And we can see its manifestations in different ways, including the example that you gave just now, that the great Russia, is facing a proxy war. It's not a war. It's not a conflict between Russia and Ukraine, because Ukrainians are fraternal people. They're brothers and sisters of Russian people. It is a war imposed by NATO, which wants to expand, quite contrary to the assurances that NATO itself had given in early 1990, that they will not expand by even one inch. They are consistently expanding and getting closer and closer to Russia and threatening Russia's sovereignty, Russia's integrity, and even Russia's future survival.
Now, Mr. Kulkarni, as much as I want to continue talking about that, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few seconds. Stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to World Apart with Sudhindra Kulkarni, Indian political analyst. Mr. Kulkarni, I think we both agree that de-Westernization and democratization are synonymous processes, allowing all demises, all nations, the freedom to be themselves, to pursue their own development according to their distinct national features in this synergetic way, in what the Americans used to call win-win fashion. And yet, it is also pretty clear that Western nations have managed to essentially hijack the democratic discourse. They're using democracy essentially as a stick against anyone who disagrees with the Western paradigm. How do you think this whole idea of democracy, which is actually a very inspiring idea, and it is also at the root of major philosophies that we have discussed before, that each nation or each individual has to leave out the authentic nature that, powers that be seeded into him or into his nation. How do you think the idea of democracy can be wrestled back so that it is not used as a stick, but rather as an inspiring and motivating ideal?
First of all, the West and the United States in particular is itself giving a very bad advertisement for continued democracy in those countries. Now look at what is happening within America. People are getting increasingly disillusioned with the way political parties and the governments function, the way political leaders are polarizing the society with no cooperation and no consensus on any matter. Therefore, I don't think that we need to do a lot more to finish Western democratic dominance, because the West is doing it itself. It is digging its own grave. But what is our responsibility? Responsibility of countries like India, China, Russia, in Africa, in other countries in Asia and Latin America, we have to establish a superior example. First of all, democracy must mean better living conditions for all people. Similarly, beyond material progress, there should be cultural progress of all human beings and all communities. And this is where countries like Russia, China, and many other countries, including India, have so much to offer for a new stage of human evolution. And I must, I'm talking to a Russian friend, I'm so deeply influenced and inspired by the great writers and philosophers of Russia. The same is true for China. I frequently visit China, and I'm most inspired by the fact that China has become free of extreme poverty. Now, isn't that also a form of democratic revival? Giving decent living conditions for every Chinese citizen, isn't that a form of democratic protection? So therefore, we have to establish superior examples.
You have noted that this process of de-Westernization, and by that you don't mean the trying to remove the West, not going to war with the West, because Western countries also represent a very valuable heritage and value for human experience, but simply dislodging them from their self-assumed position of hegemony. As you noted, this process of de-Westernization is accompanied by the creation of many other organizations like BRICS, like many others, which are based on authentic consensus, on pragmatic rather than ideological decision-making, on trying to truly find the areas where the countries can find their mutual interests. Do you think those principles can ever be attractive to our Western neighbors? Because as your former boss said, we cannot choose them. Do you think we can sort of tempt them by our own example?
No, the West will certainly not voluntarily accept and welcome these new developments, which point to a new world order based on multipolarity. BRICS is one example, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, African Union, Similarly, Gulf Cooperation Council, there are so many such regional and even multi-continental, transcontinental, multilateral organizations that are coming up. Some of these are evolving, expanding like BRICS. We don't know what shape they'll take in future. But one thing is very clear, that G7, group of seven, you know, this exclusive club of Western countries is losing its influence, economic influence, political influence, diplomatic influence, and therefore it is trying to create some new tricks to somehow split the unity and solidarity of other countries. And this is how I see quadrilateral, quad, the four-country alliance headed by the United States, which they see as a precursor to an Asian NATO. They have already created havoc in Europe, and they want to now export the same havoc and destruction to Asia. We must not allow NATO to come anywhere close to Asia.
Now, on a personal level, how do you understand the logic of this military expansion? Because as you mentioned before, if we look at the, you know, developments within, let's say, the American society over the last 20 years, many of the benefits that they had, they lost. I mean, population-wise, you know, it used to be a very inspiring country where people could have decent standards of life, sometimes underwritten by the rest of the world. But there was this notion of the American dream that, you know, the next generation will be a little bit better off than the previous one. All of that is now gone. They have wasted all the benefits they had, or many of the benefits they had, because of this very, I think, irresponsible power application in you know, war zones around the world. What do you see? How do you see the logic of this continuing military expansion when their own populations continue to decline in terms of material resources available to them, as well as, you know, spiritual, cultural resources and all the rest?
You're absolutely right. Today, lots of Americans themselves are questioning why America is pouring so many resources into Ukraine for the war, for the continuation of the war, when their own infrastructure is declining at a very rapid rate. There is so much poverty. The bottom half of American society is finding it extremely difficult to have what you said, the American dream. So, United States is certainly undergoing its own internal transformation. We do not know what form it will take in the years to come. But I would say that the rise of the rest and decline of the West is an irreversible phenomenon. Now, what we should do is, whether east or west, north or south, we must propound global solidarity and global cooperation of the highest order, of the kind that the world has never seen. So east, west, north, south, we are one family, one global family. And as you earlier pointed out, this will also include people of the West themselves. After all, even the Western countries have contributed in a very significant way to the evolution of human civilizations in technology, in science, in art. What we oppose is Western domination, Western hegemony, which is against the principles of global democracy.
And I think it's not only against the principles of global democracy, it's also against the principles of fair sharing of the benefits of humanity. And what you've been talking about, this idea of solidarity, it's no longer, in my view at least, an ethical principle. This is what history necessitates. I mean, this is where development goes, that if you actually live on good mutual terms with your neighbors, you benefit from it. Your populations benefit from it. And as a political party or as a political leader, you can actually, you know, reap the benefits rather than using politics only as a means, as I said in the beginning, of self-aggrandizing or appeasing your owner narcissism. Now, we have only a minute left, and I do want to ask you one question about India, because you mentioned that the United States is going through its process of internal transformation. So is India. And recently there has been a controversy about whether India is preparing for a change of name, because the presidential palace sent out invites for a major gala dinner stating or in the name of the president of Bharat. Now, as far as I understand, this is an old name for India in Hindi, as opposed to India being a name in English. And we've seen a number of countries, Turkey being one example, that have changed their names to native languages, to how they sound in native languages. What do you make of it? Where does India fit into that? And do you think this controversy has any sort of potential to be realized?
You know, it would be totally wrong on the part of a country to rename itself by removing the word India. In our constitution, the very first line of our constitution says, India, that is Bharat. So we accept both names. We have India, we are also Bharat. And that's true about several other countries in the world. For example, China has a different name in Chinese language, but it is known as China to the rest of the world. Now, India is as much an Indian name as Bharat. For example, in English, the language in which we are speaking, English today, very soon there'll be more English-speaking people in India than in the United States or certainly United Kingdom. English is our language. So we don't disown English and we don't disown India. India is a source of immense inspiration and pride for us, and so is Bharat. And if any stupid people in India want to change the name, it'll be unsustainable, it'll be rechanged.
Now, I don't want to get into this political controversy in India, but one thing I know is that Bharat, one of the interpretations of this word is that it originates from the word Bha, which means light, and India certainly has been a light for the rest of humanity, not the only light, but one that brings very rich and very multifaceted rays of light onto the rest of humanity. And you being from that country, I want to thank you for this very spirited and I think very rich conversation.
But I must say the same light also emanates from Russia, a country that I deeply love and admire.
Thank you very much.
And spasiba.
Thank you to you as well. And that light emanates from each and every country and each and every person around the world. And we have to admit and respect that. But for now, thank you very much for watching and hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.